Football Weekly.
Purple rain, purple rain. Sir Alex and Man United stay on top after weekend with more late drama than a whole series of 6 feet under. The Potters was scraping past a side Liverpool had already thrashed 5-0, a sign of weakness or the decisive step for the title. There's more from the Premier League and the latest at the bottom, where it's the Shearer era and relegation's nearer. Elsewhere, there's the usual tip-top continental coverage. Sid, Raphael and more as we preview those Champions League quarterfinals. Is this a vintage Porto side and are Bayern spent after their 5-1 Wolfsburg mauling? All that plus pose and much, much more in Football Weekly. On board today, everybody, Sean Ingle, the podcaster's podcaster.
Hello, James.
Hi there. Cheeky funster Barry Glendinning.
Hello.
Hello. And the man who turns up almost as often as Amir Zaki, Paul Doyle.
Hi.
So far, we managed to establish that I can do a pretty spot-on impression of Andy Bell dancing, of Erasure, yeah.
But better still, Barry, yeah. Just as we were going into broadcast, was about to confess that he's been to an Erasure concert.
He's been to an Erasure concert, Barry.
I have been to an Erasure. I went to see a Erasure gig in the SFX in Dublin.
Uh-huh.
And it was very good, but I did feel slightly like a fish out of water. I'm pretty certain I was the only heterosexual man in the building.
Right.
But I've since been to a Mark Almond gig as
right.
well, and where I was one of two heterosexual men in the building. But that too was good. Your Mr. sort of gay man knows how to have a good time, it has to be said.
All right then. Gay men everywhere. You get the Barry Glendinning seal of approval. I have to say, our chums at Music Weekly, they are, I think, to a man, big Erasure fans. I don't get that myself, but... What a weekend. Two thrilling games at the top of the Premier League. Makeda's goal being hailed as the turning point, possibly in the way that Steve Bruce's was all those years ago, etc., etc. But they're still just 1 point clear. Is this all a bit premature?
I think it is premature, yes. While they won yesterday, their display was far from convincing. Their defence, and admittedly, they were missing a lot of players who would have been first choice, well, possibly five, six. But Gary Neville and John O'Shea, who just got ripped apart yesterday and were really shaky. And yeah, I wouldn't be counting any chickens yet if I was a Manchester United fan. But it was a huge, huge win for them all the same.
Well, having sort of tipped United all the way, I feel like someone that's haven't been presented with the fact that the world is in fact round still believes it's flat. You're looking at me puzzledly. Well, all the evidence is that Liverpool are absolutely flying. United are struggling desperately. I still think United wings. They're a point ahead and have got a game in hand.
Yeah.
But Barry's right. They've played very poorly. Ferguson's lucky in a way that Makeda has come in and scored this wonder goal at the end, because playing Gary Neville a centre-half to mark, you know, big John Carew was a ridiculous decision. And you know, they were very nearly paid for it.
But it was a one-off situation. Is that the point, that if United were going to drop the points, it was going to be here when they had Vidic and Ferdinand out?
They have they still have the easier run in, and I think they will go on to win the league. Liverpool are bound to be distracted a little bit by playing Chelsea twice in the week, and United have the bigger squad. They should win, but you know, the way they're playing at the moment, who knows? I mean, other teams have picked up momentum. You look back at United in 2002-03 when they came from nowhere to win the league. You look at United in 96-97. You look at Arsenal in 97-98. It is possible for these teams just to pick up a huge wedge of steam and to win the league, and Liverpool still might do it.
I don't think it's possible for anyone to pick up a wedge of steam for myself. But
it's not so long ago that Old Trafford was, you know, a veritable fortress, and
yeah.
United defence hadn't conceded in however many hours of football, and now teams seem to be able to score against them, not quite at will, but, you know, fairly easily.
Well, hopefully that's a legacy of Liverpool's win there, because few teams actually attacked them with gusto prior to that, and Liverpool showed that it could be done. What the goal by Makeda did also show is what we've known all along, really, is that United do have a stronger squad. Liverpool are undoubtedly playing better at the moment, but when earlier in the season they had to rely on people like Elzar and David Ngo, they didn't produce the goods in the way that Makeda did, and that those draws that could yet prove costly.
What a day for him, eh?
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, he's 17 years old. Yeah. You know,
is that his first Premier League appearance?
It was his first Premier League appearance. He's got a big Facebook page where he's got pictures of himself with lots of attractive young ladies. I was just wondering, Jimbo, what was the reaction in Italy? I suppose Gazzetta have gone big on it, have they?
You'll be surprised to hear they haven't. Front page of today's Gazette has got a little colour picture of it. Should you let me dig it out? Somewhere down here.
Our viewers will appreciate that effort on your part.
Well, that's a different one. Oh, is
While you're rooting around your box,
Erasure Weekly.
Jim.
Here we go. The Italian Makeda launches Manchester. Victorious goal at 17. Tiny. I mean, how was that? A couple of centimetres, that photo? Photograph of him. And it says, you know, so I thought, oh, well, I'll look at what they've got inside. But nothing inside. They've got an article on their website. And it doesn't say this is a scandal because he should by right to be playing at Lazio. It basically just says, oh, look at this. An Italian's got a big role to play in the Premier League. They're quite excited about that. But of course, he is. When he did go to Manchester United, they were all crying scandal, and Lazio were busy talking about how they were going to report United to FIFA or UEFA or whoever for making illegal contact with the player's family, because he was only 15 at the time when they first started making contact. And the thing is that in England you can offer professional terms, I think, from 16, whereas in Italy you can't do it until they're 18. And this is why from Gattuso onwards, you know, Giuseppe Rossi, various bright young talents have been snapped up by the Pied Pipers, if you will, of the Premier League. Yeah.
If you want to be, and I will be accused of sour grapery or whatever, and I don't have any sour grapes, but there were a couple of things. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo's free kick probably shouldn't have been allowed because it was...
Why?
Well, it was, the free kick was taken several yards back from where the free kick was conceded. And if it had been taken from the correct place, Cristiano Ronaldo wouldn't have been able to have that shot on goal. And then there were also grumbles about the amount of injury time that were given to United. But again, the goal was scored in the third minute of added time, which is probably fair enough.
Right. So on the subject of Cristiano Ronaldo, a terrific performance from him.
Well, it wasn't totally terrific because he was very much at fault for the... first Villa goal.
Right, a mixed performance from Cristiano Ronaldo. But interestingly, in the light of the big news on, what was it, Friday, that if it is news, Sean, is it news? £75 million, is it, or million euros?
Sort of. I mean, it's
Real Madrid.
The Guardian's exclusive with the Daily Mail on Saturday is that Ronaldo will go to Real Madrid in the summer, which we've sort of heard before. But the twist is that this is actually a secret deal. It was agreed last September. Both sides, you know, signed confidentiality clauses and the like, and it will happen.
Does sound like it's true then, Sean, if it's in the Daily Mail anyway, because that's a reputable publication. There you go. Liverpool have to wait for another day then to move past United. It would be entirely appropriate, though, for the comeback kings of this season to leave it to the very last minute if they were to take the title. But anyway, that's enough on the title race. Downstairs... Borough look in a similar predicament now to West Brom, but nothing's going to happen to Southgate, is it? They're just going to...
It would appear not, no.
Yeah. Okay.
He seems to have licence to do as badly as he right. likes. And he's been very dignified in defeat after defeat after defeat. But you have to start to worry about his mental health at this stage, because I thought he was going to burst into tears when he was being interviewed on Match of the Day on Saturday night. And maybe it's time for him just to say, look, I'm not up to this, and walk away and
you
take
do
a holiday.
You at least want to see a bit of spirit and a bit of fight from his team, with 4-1 tonking by Bolton.
They're a strange one, because they remind me of one of these kids that they show a flash of potential, but most of the time they're just boozing and drinking and ruining their life away. I mean, they have beaten Liverpool, they have beaten Villa, they have drawn with Arsenal this season. And yet
there,
just...
but for the flash of potential goes Barry Glenn.
But what interests me more is Newcastle, because we gave a big billing to Shearer, and they weren't very good against Chelsea. But on Football Focus, the BBC show on Saturday, Garth Crooks was interviewing his mate, and Shearer admitted, a friend of mine asked me this question: if you don't take the job and Newcastle stay up, will you regret it? And the answer was yes.
It's a strange way of putting it.
So it's basically he didn't want someone else to take the glory. Yeah,
yeah.
I actually thought that he just got that wrong, he was tongue-tied, or he misheard the question. Mm.
But you think Sunderland are the team that are going to...
Well, West Brom are down. Middlesbrough's players appear to have thrown in the towel, even if their manager hasn't, so I would say they're down. And then it would appear to be one of Sunderland or Newcastle that'll go with them.
I think Hull, there's still a good chance of Hull of going down. And they have to play all the teams who are down there at the bottom, so somebody could save themselves by beating Hull and thereby condemn Hull, who aren't playing well, really struggling to score and not keeping clean sheets.
Well, according to the Guardian today, the figures, which I think are right, Hull have got 5 of their last 7 games away from home, and their 2 home games against Liverpool and Man United.
Well, what did the Mail say about that?
I think we should big up Tony Pulis, yes, or whatever, because they look safe and they could yet finish in the top half because in the form they're showing. And he hasn't spent a great deal of money. Obviously, Dave Kitson was a poor purchase, but they're doing what Bolton did many years ago. They came into the division. They're incredibly hard to play against. They're not pretending to be world beaters yet. And you imagine that once he establishes them in the top flight, they will gradually get more flair into the team.
Back on the subject, I agree with Paul that Pulis deserves big kudos, and we probably don't give Stoke enough credit or whatever they do deserve.
Or Mali. No. Or Greek football.
No, or Greek football, or Cypriot League. Mm. Or many, no, we many
do quite
teams.
A lot on the Cypriots. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you compare Stoke to Sunderland, for example, who spent a fortune both last year and this summer in a bid to drive themselves up into the top half, including one of their good purchases, Danny Higginbotham.
Right.
They didn't know how to use him, and now he's doing well at Stoke.
No, fair point. That's probably enough for part one, but more Premier League-ish action in a second when we talk about the Champions League quarter-finals, Liverpool-Chelsea and that.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Sean wants to talk about Luton, but we're determined to keep listeners hanging on to the end for that top Johnson Paints Trophy coverage. Right now, we'll just clear up this Champions League quarter-final business now. First off, Liverpool-Chelsea, a byword for dull and tedious football until that second leg of the semi-final last year, the 3-2 win for Chelsea. What's it going to be like this time, do we think?
Well, I was sort of doing a bit of prep for today's pod, and I had a page of my copy, you know, for each of the four games.
Yes.
And the Liverpool-Chelsea one is blank because, well, there's just nothing left to say about it.
Well, Liverpool have beaten Chelsea twice in the league this season.
I don't know which way it's going to go. I'm not tremendously interested in watching the games.
Gerrard had watch a tweak or a twang at the cottage. I don't know if that's... But he's meant to be fit. Drogba, they're still...
I think Liverpool will win, simply because I'm not convinced that Hiddink has got Chelsea playing any better than they were earlier in the season.
Right, fair point. Let's move straight on then to Man United Porto, because I believe we've all come to the party with a little something on the Portuguese runaway leaders, a team who've only lost twice in their last 24 matches, and both times it's because they were fielding an understrength team in the Portuguese League Cup. And, you know, they're full of confidence.
Well, they are. I mean, Barry and I were talking when we came in, and Porto are 9-1 to win at Old Trafford, which is a stonking bet. I mean 9-1 suggests that they've only got a 11% chance of winning. But they're playing a United side that haven't played for, you know, have only just played. They haven't been playing very well. As you say, Portugal are flying in the league. They were very good in the last round against Atletico Madrid, who admittedly aren't much of a team. And they've got a better chance than their odds suggest, I think, of beating United.
Well, interesting. Rio Ferdinand's still going to be out for that game, apparently.
Yeah, he seems to have an injured groin.
Some of the same defensive confusion that we saw on Sunday, perhaps, for the Portuguese visitors.
Porto very much have a winning mentality, particularly away from home, having won 10 out of their last 11, the other being a draw. But you probably knew that, James. And they also have a lot of Argentinians on their side.
Right.
Their squad, I think, is half Portuguese and then the other half is compiled of about 6 or 7 Argentinians and 3 or 4 Brazilians.
Right.
One of the Argentinians being their star striker, Lisandro, who has scored 6 in the Champions League this season out of 17 shots on goal.
You have to mention their other striker. It would be incredible not to mention him.
We're better than that. The Brazilian Hulk is the man you speak of.
That's him.
Yep, excellent. And, well, there you go. United, are they going to be a bit worn out, do you think, from all the emotion of their dramatic late Old Trafford win?
I think it could be a case of, you know, being a bit after the Lord Mayor's show. I am going to get stuck into Porto anyway at 9-1.
Right, okay.
Well, if they do knock United out, you might want to bear in mind that on the only 2 previous occasions when they've won their European quarterfinals, they've gone on to win the trophy.
Right, and the last time was against Man United.
Yeah.
On the European front, Fabregas is going to Spain for this week's Champions League quarterfinal because Arsenal are in Villarreal. Young Cesc making his way back onto the field for their victory this weekend against Man City. So they got Adebayor back. They got Cesc Fabregas back. They got their mojo back, haven't they?
They really? Have. I mean, I had a very quick scan on Soccerbase, and I think they've only had one defeat in 22 games, and that was against Roma. Also, it's quite interesting the number of clean sheets they've kept, and it reminds me a little bit of in 2006 when they reached Champions League final, having not played very well in the league, but managing to, you know, keep a lot of clean sheets and put it together in the last. Sort of
memory
of
serves,
months.
They've had seven in a row now, which is. Surely the equal of their record run back in 1998-99.
Good knowledge, Jimbo. Almost sounded as if you weren't reading it off a piece of paper.
Seven
clean sheets.
Seven at home. I've just seven at home. Seven.
Yeah, in fairness, they didn't look defensively sound on Saturday. City exposed them when they bothered to. Toure and Gallas, there was a lot of there was a lack of coordination in that defence, and you imagine that remains. A possible vulnerability, as you know, all the great attacking players are coming back, and they were brilliant going forward. But that remains an Achilles heel.
Villarreal had a disastrous weekend as well. They got whipped 3-0 by Almeria, and they've lost their ever-present midfielder Santi Cazorla with a broken leg for the rest of the season.
Right.
So and Bobby Pires got sent off as well.
Right,
but that won't affect.
Pretty speech just lets it. No, we won't be needing them this week. Barry's got that covered. Let's hear more about the Yellow Submarines, Los Submarinos Amarillos, or something, from Dr. Sid.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, Sid. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you.
Lots to talk about this week, Simon. And let's see, well, Villarreal, Barry's done the groundwork there for you. Are they going to, what kind of opposition are they, you know, Cazorlas, but with Pires back? What's it going to be like then?
Well, I think they've got one really big problem, and that's that Santi Cazorla broke his leg this weekend. He's out for the rest of the season.
That's old news, Sid. We know that already.
Yeah, but that really makes a difference to the way they play. I was talking to Marcos Senna a week or so ago and talking about the way that Villarreal have kind of overcome the departure of Riquelme and who it is that's really kind of stepped into the breach to make them a footballing team. And obviously, I think there are two players who are really outstanding in replacing Riquelme. And one is Robert Pires, and the other is Marcos Senna himself. And one of the questions I asked him was this. I said, you know, it seems to me that kind of two players have stepped in a bit. And obviously, typical ass-kissing of a footballer when you're interviewing. Oh, well, you're great, Marcos. You're the one who stepped into his place. And he said, no, don't rule out the importance of Santi Cazorla, because he's the one that keeps the ball moving. He's the one that makes us creative. He's the one that provides quite a lot of those final passes. And I think Villarreal will really miss him. They're a very, very good side, and I think they've shown in the Champions League that they're capable of defending themselves very well and not conceding goals. But I do think his absence will be a real blow for them.
Oh, that's a shame. I believe figure Arsenal as the favourites in this tie.
Yeah, I think I do. Just about. I don't think there's a huge amount in it. And I think with Santi Cazorla, maybe it would be that little bit closer again. And as I say, Villarreal are a very, very good side. When they've got everyone available. Now, there's a couple of question marks about the defence. The two centre-backs, Gonzalo and Godin, when they play together, they're very, very good. When they don't, they're not very good. I think Villarreal still lack a little bit of strength and depth in defence, but they've got an awful lot of technical quality throughout the rest of the side. The midfield keeps the ball brilliantly. They're very, very creative. And there's also a bit of a question mark about the strikers because they keep having injuries. They keep chopping and changing a little bit. But I do think they're a genuinely good side, but probably not quite as good as Arsenal.
In other news, the title race looks pretty much over. Barcelona and Madrid both winning, but Barcelona looking much better than Madrid. So let's talk about pigs.
Yeah, let's talk about pigs. Yeah, let's talk about them. Fantastic. I really do love this story. Basically, what happened was that, and this is not new, by the way, in Spain. This has been going on for years, that football clubs are given incentives by local businessmen or local restaurants or whatever it may be to try and play well. And we're talking not cash incentives, but normally food incentives. So I remember when I used to live in Oviedo many years ago, the scoreboard used to flash up every goal a lobster. And for every goal that an Oviedo player scored, he got a lobster, which I thought was absolutely fantastic. You know, I have this image of these players walking around with a load of crustaceans hanging off them. And they're not the only ones to do it. When Xabi Alonso played for Real Sociedad, he used
was
to
there a lobster clause in their contract then? Or
very good, I like it. Can I just copy that and just add that into my column, which I'm currently finishing? That's stolen from James Richardson. Brilliant.
He wouldn't credit you if he nicked it from you, so don't bother.
So I don't even need to say that. Okay. Oh, dear.
Well, don't clam up. Go on.
Anyway, this isn't new. What's happened in Navarre, where Oviedo are from, is that a local businessman has announced that if Espanyol could beat If Osasuna could beat Espanyol, which a big relegation clash a week ago, two teams really in trouble, if they could beat them, he would give them 12 suckling pigs. Now, this is obviously a fantastic plan. Osasuna then go and win in the 92nd minute against Espanyol to collect their pigs. There's just one slight problem. The guy who scores a 92nd minute winner is Iranian and doesn't eat pork. To which this guy who was providing the pigs said, "Oh, sorry, I'll chuck him a couple of chickens or something." But anyway, last week, Osasuna take delivery of these 12 pigs. They took delivery of them live. So there's these lovely photos of them with these cuddly little mascots who've been painted Osasuna's colours, red and blue, although according to the guy who delivered them, he said, yeah, they've gone a bit pink because they were getting a bit nervous on the journey. I bet they were getting nervous on the journey. And they sweated a bit and they've gone pink. So you've got this great photograph of Carlos Cruchaga and Pachi Puñal, the two club captains, holding these pigs, these really cute little things, and stroking them. And these are our mascots. But of course, they're going to eat them. And I particularly like the line that Pachi Puñal said, and because loads of fans turned up to training that day, the media turned up, there were TV cameras there and everything, and he said, people were begging us to beat Espanyol. They really wanted to see these pigs live. Yeah, well, that won't last long, will it? So anyway, basically what's happened is that Osasuna have been given these 12 pigs. They are going to eat them at some stage, and they said last week, well, we'll eat them when we get a big victory, to celebrate a big victory. I suspect they might be eating them this week because they thrashed Atletico Madrid 4-2 last night, which just goes to prove that, as I told you last week, absolutely nothing has changed at the Vicente Calderon.
There you go. Well, listen, last off then, Sid, unless there's something else we should need to know about, Barcelona, who are taking on Bayern Munich, of course, in the Champions League quarterfinals. How are things at the new camp?
Well, they're very good. They feel that the 1-0 victory over Valladolid, which doesn't sound very impressive, was a really big step towards the title, because it was a difficult away trip off the back of international duty. Bear in mind that four times Barcelona have played off the back of international duty this year, and they've not won three of them. They'd only managed to win one. And there was a feeling that showed that they've got the strength in depth. They also rested players. They will be fit for Bayern Munich. Dani Alves, Thierry Henry and Leo Messi on the bench, which isn't bad. They think this is a good tie for them. They think it's not too bad. I have to say, I don't honestly know enough about Bayern Munich to say for sure, but Barca do look very strong indeed.
All right, well, stay tuned then, because in a second or two, we'll be speaking to a man who knows all about all things Munchen, and that is Raphael Honigstein. In the meantime, Dr. Sid in Madrid, many, many thanks.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Well, actually, I lied there. We're not going to go straight to Raphael. We're going to get some posts in, Paul Doyle. Posts.
Good.
Barry Glen Canadia says, can the pod explain to those of us outside your beautiful wee islands why there was such outrage over Barry Ferguson's surreptitious little victory signal? He can't possibly have been banned from Scotland for life for that.
Why not?
Well, it was quite a strong decision. Okay, just to recap, these two were chucked out of dropped from the first team for Scotland after staying up all night drinking until lunchtime the next day after Scotland's defeat against Holland. The next game, they're left on the bench and they basically pose for photographers with their hands in a very subtle V shape over their faces. And the Scottish authorities are so outraged that they banned them from Scottish football for life. Ferguson and Alan McGregor, the two players, are also both dropped from Rangers and transfer listed, and apparently told privately that they won't play for the club again either. All for a couple of schoolboy gestures?
Well, no, the reason they've been told transfer listed by Rangers is because Rangers are skint and need money, and they need to get Ferguson off the payroll, and they need McGregor as one of their few saleable assets. So this is a very convenient excuse for Rangers to put transfer list them. I wouldn't imagine the V signs have much to do with it apart from that. And as far as the Scotland thing is concerned, you know, they misbehaved by going on the piss for 8 hours after a defeat and in between two games in front of members of the public in a hotel bar. So they should have just taken their punishment like men and apologised. And instead they carried out this unbelievably childish act of petulance and have rightfully been sort of told they won't play again. I mean, neither of them are any great loss. Ferguson is way past his prime and is injury prone and more trouble than he's worth by the looks of things. And McGregor wasn't first choice keeper anyway.
Yeah.
And Ferguson is the national team captain, and in football, captaincy is largely a ceremonial role, and all you have to do is not flip V signs at supporters, really. And if you can't even do that, then there's probably no place for him.
Yeah.
Plus, you might remember at Rangers, Paul Le Guen clashed with him. What was it two years ago now? Was it? And he tried to get him to mend his crazy ways, but he wouldn't. And it turns out Le Guen was right.
Well, there you go, kids. Slim Pickens, ahoy podsters. My question this week, with the news that Sven-Göran Eriksson is to get a £7 million payoff from Mexico, although Sean Engel, I think you want to question that figure, is he the first manager to earn more not to manage than he did to do so? You can understand why, though, people would pay Sven not to manage their team.
I mean, well, possibly, but Sven is living the dream. I think almost every person out there probably dreams of, you know, joining a company, somehow being promoted to the board. Then when you get to the top and being paid a big mega salary, fecking it all up, forgive my French, and then just getting a big payoff. But Sven's not just done it once, he's done it, you know, three times now. I think it's $7 million in total from England, from Manchester City and from Mexico. And it really is astonishing. But it's, you know, it's...
And yet, the stories are in today's Scooptastic Guardian that Chelsea are once more sniffing around him.
Well, he really wants to get back into English football. Mm. We know that.
That's where the payoffs are, I think, though.
I mean, I feel for poor Tord Grip here, because Tord Grip is the one that goes around, scouts all the players, you know, does all the groundwork. It's a bit not like Animal Farm, really. Well, you've got, I mentioned my fiver the other day, you've got, you know, the poor workhorse, you know, bit stupid, doing all the work, and you've got Napoleon the Pig, which is Ericsson, just sitting back and just standing on his little heels, doing everything. Sorry, no one here has read Animal Farm, have they?
I've read Animal Farm.
Poor Boxer. Yeah. Well, Tord Grip is Boxer and Sven is Napoleon.
Right. Well, it was an interesting perspective there. Thanks for that, Sean. Now, Mike in LA, among many people correcting me on my erroneous assertion that the CONCACAF group that Mexico are in will only send two teams automatically through. It's three.
It's three if they win a playoff, isn't it?
Well, no, he says three, and then the fourth one goes into a playoff against the South American
team. Far too many from that group.
Mm. Croc wants a shout-out for www.nomoreonionbags.com.
And you're not yet a hospital radio DJ. give it a year. But
Chimanca poco, as they say in Italy. Southampton, Steve Grant. Disappointed there was no mention of Southampton's parent company going into administration yesterday, because that's the kind of fun story we revel in here on the pod.
We're all authorities on the subject.
With the administrator, I don't know why we're laughing about this, stating that we'll have a knock-on effect to the football club. Basically, Rupert Lowe's walked out. They've got 6 weeks to save the club, otherwise they go into administration. But they're not going to get points deducted. Are they just going to dissolve? Or what's
they've managed to find some loophole that, to be honest, I'm not even going to pretend to understand what's going on, because I just don't. And I find it really... I feel sorry for Southampton's fans, and I feel sorry for Matt Le Tissier, but I just don't care anymore about that kind of thing.
I think a lot of this, though, is based on this whole... I mean, it's a wider issue. Two things. First of all, Southampton used to be a fairly well-run club back in the day. You know, not always, and certainly, you know, Rupert Lowe, it's not everyone's cup of tea, but they've overspent. They've basically gone the way of so many football clubs over the last few years. And you know, what's happened with Southampton has happened with Luton, which we'll talk about later, and so on.
Are you happy now, Steve Grant? You see what you've done here?
It would not surprise me if several other clubs in the next year or so go
name
down
name,
the same route.
Sean.
No, I won't, but I think if Portsmouth go down, they would be in a lot of trouble. Mm. I think if Sunderland go down, there may be some issues there.
Luton, Sean, did they not play in an extremely exciting Wembley final just this very weekend?
It was an absolute humdinger. I'd go as far as to say...
Was it that good?
It was probably
a humdinger.
It was probably the greatest Wembley Cup final since 1988 when Luton beat Arsenal 3-2, which sounds a ridiculous thing to say. But if you go back and think, you know, the last best two FA Cup finals in recent years were West Ham-Liverpool and Liverpool-Arsenal, both at Cardiff. Best League Cup final in the last 15 years was Chelsea-Liverpool in 2005 at Cardiff. It was an amazing game. Luton were 1-0 down, being hammered, you know, recovered, went 2-1 up. Then, you know, Grant McCann hit a stunner for Sunforth right at the end, and then Luton won it in extra time. And, you know, it was an absolute thriker a game, if that's a word.
I don't think it is. Well,
language doesn't exist to encapsulate the magnificence of this victory, basically. Invent some more sounds to describe the
but
game.
But it reminded me of an old-fashioned game, because both teams just really went for it. There were gaps everywhere on the pitch, lots of shots, lots of saves, and Barry Glendening, who I spoke to earlier, really enjoyed it too.
But... Oh dear. If you have anything you'd like to get Sean to rant on semi-intelligibly, do post in guardian.co.uk/footballweekly.
Send us your thwakers of posts.
Anyway,
while we're here, sorry, yep, we should probably mention as well Mike Dean getting hit by a coin,
yep,
at the
Swansea Cardiff
game yesterday. Cardiff fan threw a coin, hit him on the head. Mm. Which, not nice.
Not nice at all.
Entirely predictable, which is a bit sad, but there you go.
Right. That's it for part two. Very, very shortly, we'll get the other side of that Bayern-Barca quarterfinal when we dial up Raphael Honigstein. Where in the wide world of football reporting are you, Raphael Honigstein?
I'm just on Tottenham Court Road, but in a building.
Oh, right, okay. Wow. All right.
Let me see, one second. Yes, I think this one, yeah. Oh, no, there's someone sitting in there.
Oh. Why are we waiting? There's someone from the Oxford English Dictionary wants to know how I spell Thryker.
No.
T-H-R-Y-K-E-R.
Right. Okay.
How's this?
Okay. Have you found an unoccupied one?
I think this should be fine here.
All right, then. Listen, we were just talking with Sid about Barcelona-Bayern. Bayern, of course, returning to the stadium where they lost so catastrophically the Champions League final back in, whenever it was, 1990. Yeah, yes, that's the one. What's the viewpoint there after that tremendous thrashing they got from Wolfsburg at the weekend?
I think they're really scared. I think Matthias Sammer, the general director of the German FA, said, I don't think Barcelona will be that much worse than Wolfsburg. And that's that's the feeling that was prevailing at Bayern. They will probably be without Lucio at the back. The back is where all the problems are this year. Without him, they don't really have a lot.
Did Lucio play in the Wolfsburg game?
He did, and the problem was he got injured. But he, in his typical Lucio style, refused to go off. And was still trying to score goals when Bayern were 3-1 down. And then didn't come back in time, and Wolfsburg scored a couple goals more.
Mm.
Really horrible performance, both on an individual, but also collectively. Bayern were just absolutely dreadful.
Right. So, well, now I should just put things in perspective for anyone who's not been keeping abreast on the Bundesliga. Things very tight at the top. Wolfsburg, who are one of four teams within, I think we're within a point of each other or something crazy like that last week, took on Bayern Munich, beat them 5-1. So Wolfsburg are now tied on top with Hamburg, 2 points clear of Hertha Berlin, the previous leaders. Bayern Munich now a whopping 3 points off the pace. And there you've got Jürgen Klinsmann complaining about the fact that his players gave up. And that did he say that this Barcelona game is going to decide the club's future or something?
Well, he did say that the future of Bayern is at stake. I think he's talking more in general terms, because Bayern are at the moment only fourth in the league, which has made them lose out on the Champions League yet again after 2007. And I think what he's also saying is that my future is very much at stake, because while they might just forgive him getting knocked out by Barcelona, which is fair enough, really, on any given day, if he were to lose out on the Champions League, I don't think that the Bayern board will hesitate 1 second in getting rid of him. Of course, the irony was that they were playing against Felix Magath, who took over Wolfsburg, who was a Bayern manager, won the double, and then got fired, despite winning the doubles back-to-back. So Klinsmann, you know, is a miles away from winning anything, might get the sack as well, of course.
My word. How bad's the scoreline going to be then, do you think, in Barcelona?
Well, of course, Barcelona have been saying that after 5-1, Bayern will now make sure that this won't happen again. But without Lucio, with a very, very shaky back four, with a Podolski that's not interested, I think the best Bayern can hope for is a sort of a lucky 2-1 defeat where they somehow scramble one in. I mean, incidentally, they were in a similar shape when they met AC Milan 2 years ago, but they somehow concocted to draw 2-2. It was a bizarre result, really. And then, of course, they got done at home by Milan in the return leg.
Right. And are Wolfsburg the new favourites for the title, briefly?
I think they are. They are. They've won now 8 games on the trot. And they've got a fairly easy rest program because of all the good teams at home and all the less good teams away from home. So it's perfect for them. They're not involved in Europe or any cup anymore. So while you wouldn't say it's theirs to lose now, they're certainly in a great position.
Excellent. Well, we'll catch up with you soon, I hope.
All right, James. Take care. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, Raphael. Barry, you were doing a pub quiz last night, and Korea was one of the answers. Is that right?
Yes.
Which leads us on nicely to a bit of information.
You don't want to know what the question was.
What was the question?
Where was the TV show MASH set?
Right.
The answer was Korea. But yeah, South Korea beat North Korea 1-0 in a World Cup.
How did you do in your pub quiz?
Pretty badly. It was a debacle pub quiz, though. It was very poorly done. You couldn't hear the music around properly.
Oh, that's a shame.
And
were there any Duffy questions?
No.
Right.
But we did quite well in the music,
music round
despite the poor
erasure
acoustics.
Questions, then.
Yeah, it was all Erasure, Soft Cell and Mark Almond.
Bit of Scissor Sisters in there as well.
Yeah. But, yes, I had some of my flamboyant bachelor friends with me to help out, so we were sorted. But, North Korea lost 1-0 to South Korea in a World Cup qualifier last week. Bit of a needle match. And the North Koreans are not happy, and they've so unhappy they've been launching missiles over the weekend, which is a measure of their total lack of content over this result. But they've also accused the South Koreans of skullduggery, of poisoning their players with food poisoning.
Yep.
And they've accused the South Korean Prime Minister or President.
President,
or,
yeah, of Lee Myung-bak.
Of greasing palms in the higher levels of FIFA, so
right, who famously can't be bought. So that's crazy. Yeah, they claim that there was adulterated foodstuffs handed to their players. It was beyond all doubt that the incident was the product of a deliberate act perpetrated by adulterated foodstuff, as they could not get up all of a sudden just before the match. A statement from the North said, and they reckon that the South Korean president is behind it all. Lastly, for today's pod, I think. A quick mention of Italy, perhaps. Interesting weekend in Italy, because usually what they do is they have a game late on the Saturday and a game late on the Sunday. That what they did this time was they didn't have any Saturday games, that they played at four different slots on the Sunday, a bit like your Premier League does. And this was specifically to time in certain games for the Asian TV market. Because it was kind of like seen as a dry run for when they do their next TV deal, because the Premier League, they've noticed, gets about eight times more than Serie A does from international rights. And so
you said this was an interesting turn of events. How so?
Shackle. Other points of interest. Well, the title race is pretty much over. We thought it might be a favourable round this for Juventus, who were 7 points behind Inter, because they were hosting Little Chievo down at the wrong end of the table.
But Little Chievo got a 3-3 draw, as
they
we all
did,
know.
They did, Barry, they did. Sergio Pellissier, one of the original Flying Donkey Miracle Men, he's still there, still only 29, actually. And he scored a brilliant hat-trick at the Stadio Comunale in Turin. And there you go, a 3-3 draw, which means that Inter, who won in Udine, despite being very, very average, you'll be surprised to hear, by courtesy of a disastrous own goal by a chap called Isla, and they are now 9 points clear in Ranieri's. The Juve coach has pretty much conceded that that's it. Now, in other news, Jose Mourinho is not happy. In fact, he says he's very sad and he doesn't want to talk about Adriano, who's gone off the rails again. Adriano, who went off for Brazil's World Cup qualifiers and failed to return.
He's not only gone off the rails, he's gone off the radar, isn't he? He completely disappeared.
Even his mum didn't know where he was. Police did have a sighting of him at a favela party, one of the poor areas of town. Villa Cruz, I think, where he actually grew up in Rio. But apart from that, nobody knew where he was. He didn't get the plane home. He's now got back in contact. He's still in Rio, and I don't think we'll be coming back again anytime soon. He did offer, as a kind of rather lame excuse, I thought I had a day off. So that's why here I am 4 days later, emerging from God knows what. Because that's how the trip started as well, Barry.
Well, yes, he went off on international duty and apparently had a party in his house, which was attended by several teammates, friends, assorted ladies and assorted men dressed as ladies, transvestites, who seemed to turn up at all these Brazilian footballer parties. I'm not sure why, but anyway.
No word of him. Was Alan McGregor and Barry Ferguson, presumably?
Well, no doubt they were.
In there as well. Yes. Chuckle. Amir Zaki as well, perhaps. Who knows? Where is he? Is he in Egypt?
Yeah, he was spotted at a match in Cairo on Friday, watching it while convalescing from this injury.
He picked up an injury. That was the thing.
Yes, well, that's what he says is the reason for his non-return to England. Another possible reason is perhaps because he's locked in a bitter dispute with Mido in the World Cup game between Egypt and Zambia there last weekend. Mido didn't start, and Zaki told the media afterwards that he threw a wobbler at the manager.
Mido did.
Mido, that's what Zaki claimed. And Mido has since come out and said that Zaki is clearly trying to besmirch his reputation with these false rumours. And
because Mido's reputation is so pristine when it comes to matters international.
But it's quite a crazy career parabola that Zaki's enjoying. You know, back at the start of the season, we were all hailing him as the wonder signing of the century, and then he's completely gone off the boil.
As you might say, Sean, it's fulmobulus.
Well, a raking good podcast that was, but I think we've come to the end of it now. And if you'd like more, we'll be back on Thursday. But in the meantime, you can always find some form of solace, a quantum thereof, perchance, at guardian.co.uk. Many, many thanks to Sean, to Barry, and to Paul, and to Ben and Pete. They're nestling comfortably in the production booth. And we'll be back on Thursday. See you then.